Crusaders, an epic history of the wars for the Holy Lands, is a new book by Dan Jones, exploring and myth-busting what exactly happened during the Crusade. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK, author of Crusaders, Dan Jones himself. Dan, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. Very nice to speak to you.
Good to have you with us. Crusaders, I suppose the thing is we all have a sort of idea of the Crusades, and it's basically noble knights with white smocks and red crosses going over to the Holy Land and having a bit of a punch-up with the infidel. Is that about right?
Well, that's certainly one portion of the Crusades, and it's definitely the one that survived until today. Whether that's actually representative of the crusading period as a whole, I'm not entirely sure. And one of the things I wanted to get across in writing Crusaders was that over the sort of 400-some years of crusading during the Middle Ages, there were a huge range of people who were involved. Yes, there were lots of now dead white Frenchmen with big beards, long pointy swords, the sort of Richard the Lionheart type, if you like. But there were also people who were, you know, there were Roman Latin Christians, there were Eastern Christians, there were Turks, Arabs, Sunni and Shia Muslims, people from Egypt, Armenia, as far east as Mongolia, were all wrapped up in this war or series of wars that that were fought across the West and into the Middle East during four centuries of the Middle Ages.
And what sort of time period are we talking here? Because obviously I, with the sort of schoolboy knowledge of the Crusades, obviously automatically think Saladin, Richard the First, you know, the Battle of Acre, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and that would be the sort of era of the Third Crusade, which is towards the end of the 12th century. But the crusading period is typically dated from 1095, when Pope Urban II gave a great sermon at Clermont and called on the knights and military classes of the West to travel east and liberate Constantinople and Jerusalem. And in Crusaders, I've dated it a little earlier, because if you read the Islamic sources from the time, they're much more interested in seeing this sort of growing series of conflicts between Christian and Muslim powers across the Mediterranean. So Ibn al-Athir, the great Iraqi chronicler, says you've got to look at Sicily, where Count Roger, a Norman ruler of Sicily, had kicked the Muslim Arab rulers out of Sicily in the 1060s. Or you've got to look at Spain, you know, where the Battle of Toledo, where taken that city out of Islamic hands and put it into Christian hands. Ibn al-Athir and the chroniclers from the Muslim side would say, well, you know, it's not just the 1090s. This has been growing since well towards the middle of the 11th century. So that's kind of the beginning point of the Crusades and of the Crusader story. As for the end point, that's a matter of quite strong historical debate. You could date it to 1291, where the city of Acre fell, the last of the Crusader states of the Middle East was sort of swept away by the Mamluks, slave soldier dynasty from Egypt and Syria. Or you could push it to 1492, where in Spain, the Alhambra was handed over to the Catholic monarchs, Ferdinand and Isabella, and the last Muslim ruler was ejected from the Iberian Peninsula. And that's the date I kind of favour. I see the crusading period as going up to 1492, because then Christopher Columbus heads off across the Atlantic towards the New World, really there's a new focus in kind of Western geopolitics.
And one of the things, of course, is just you said in your opening answer to my question, it's the huge historical sweep of the nations involved and the people involved. We seem to think about Crusades being, you know, Frenchmen with pointy beards and pointy swords, but there's a whole cast, if you like, of characters with their own political and religious and geographical reasons for wanting to get involved with the Crusade.
Yeah, it's a massive story, and you know, from the beginnings in a major military expedition to Jerusalem to spin off all these kind of subplots. So from the Second Crusade in the middle of the 12th century, you start to see German nobles in Saxony saying, oh, we don't really fancy going to Jerusalem to fight. We've got lots of non-Christian people on our doorstep, the pagans of the Baltic region. So you've got a long series of wars which goes well into the 15th century in places that we now call Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, that sort of region. You've got wars in the south of France, the Albigensian Crusade waged against Cathar heretics. You see wars waged in Sicily and Italy against the Hohenstaufen dynasty. You see wars waged, of course, in Spain and Portugal, the Reconquista. There are, you know, by the time you get into the 13th and early 14th centuries, there's crusading happening absolutely everywhere. And, you know, there are people who would argue on the alt-right, the extreme right, and, you know, on the Islamist terrorist sort of groups that would argue that crusading is still going on today, because if you look at the propaganda that's issued by ISIS or the manifestos of any people like the mosque shooter in Christchurch earlier this year, you would see that they believe that this is a historical continuum and that we're still fighting a civilizational war between Christianity and Islam that dates back to the Middle Ages.
And if you look at the atrocities in Sri Lanka, I mean, it was seen as they were attacking on a crusader holiday, i.e. Easter.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I was in Sri Lanka on Easter Sunday this year when Colombo was bombed. In fact, I was supposed to be staying at one of the hotels that was blown up, 24 hours later. So, I kept a very close eye on those appalling events while I was out there, and you're absolutely right. ISIS claiming responsibility for that attack carried out by one of their offshoot organizations said, we have attacked citizens of the Crusader Coalition on, as you said, their infidel holiday. I mean, this is really sort of Route 1 propaganda, but it's proven very effective for Islamic State and other Al-Qaeda offshoots over the last sort of decade or so, claiming that their war to take over the Middle East and establish a new caliphate is part of this medieval clash of civilizations, and that it's a zero-sum game. It's us or them. And I mean, all of this is killing people today, this ideology. And I think one of the reasons I wrote Crusaders was to show that, for a start, the wars that are being waged today do not bear much resemblance to the wars that were fought in the Middle Ages. But more importantly than that, why on earth would you want to go back to a situation which engendered so much bloodshed and misery?
Let's go back, though. Let's go back to, Pope Urban and the original jihad, if you like, the original holy war. Let's retake Jerusalem from the Arabs. I mean, if I'm a young nobleman, if I'm a knight, I'm in my early 20s or something like that, there were spiritual and financial gains to be had if you went off on a crusade.
Yeah, and I think it's very different. I think it's very difficult to disentangle them. So on the one hand, there is this promise that Urban II makes in 1095. He says, if you go and fight in the name of Jesus Christ, you will be rewarded by the remission of sins. In other words, if you confess your sins and then go off and fight for Christ, your path to heaven will be eased because all of your earthly sins will be forgiven. Now, that's quite a weird bit of theological gymnastics, if you think about it. Christ, his ministry was based around turning the other cheek and the doctrine of peace and brotherhood. His name is being invoked to encourage people to go and kill other human beings. As you rightly say, there's also a sort of financial or a material motive as well. So young knights of the West in the 1090s saw what they thought would be an opportunity to go, on a very base level, plundering far from home, or if they were particularly ambitious, might have foreseen that if Jerusalem was taken and lands in what's now Syria, Palestine, Israel, Lebanon, could be appropriated, then these could be turned into new feudal holdings, new land holdings and new lordships for anyone who's brave enough to go on the journey. And that's as it turned out. After Jerusalem fell in 1099, you ended up with Western feudal-style crusader states in the Near East, Kingdom of Jerusalem, County of Tripoli, Principality of Antioch. And there was fortune to be made. However, it's worth saying that the majority of people who went crusading certainly didn't come back with riches. They usually came back bankrupt, if they came back at all.
I was going to say, because it's not this question of them sort of being cheered to the rafters all the way up to the gates of Jerusalem. They had to fight through. I mean, the Emperor of Byzantium was still going on. You had all sorts of skirmishes, and a lot of crusades never actually made it as far as getting anywhere near the Jerusalem and the Holy Land.
Well, yeah, the first crusade, which took the best part of 4 years, ultimately, to move these huge armies from France and Spain and Italy and England and so on, all the way to Constantinople, modern Istanbul, down to Jerusalem, conquering cities along the way, including Jerusalem itself. It looks like a miracle because it's so ridiculous that this should have been achievable, but they did achieve it. And because they achieved it, it looked like God was smiling upon them. Now, in a way, that's literally a blessing, but it was also a great curse because from the moment that Jerusalem was captured and the state of Crusader state of Jerusalem established, it became imperative and absolutely vital to defend it. So this became a massively draining war of the sort in the Middle East that we're still used to seeing today, where once you're committed, there's no backing down. There's no getting out of it. So over the decades, over the centuries that followed the First Crusade in 1099, you had repeated waves of crusading just in order to sort of hold the status quo and make sure that these crusader states survive. Hugely expensive military campaigns, most of which came to little more than disaster. Think of the Second Crusade, most of them were dead before they even got there. Fourth Crusade didn't even go to the Kingdom of Jerusalem, went to Constantinople, a Christian, you know, the greatest Christian city, arguably, in the world, and sacked it and burned half of the city down. So it's there are a lot of twists and turns along the way in the Crusader story.
I mean, this is the other thing. I mean, when the Crusaders got to took over cities, they were hardly setting Christian examples. I mean, I think it is the taking of Constantinople where they said that they were up to their stirrups in blood.
That's the conquest of Jerusalem in the First Crusade. There are these accounts are written in sort of biblical terms, echoing the Book of Revelation. You're absolutely right. You know, the idea of people riding up to their stirrups, up to their bridles in blood. You know, the descriptions of the sack of Constantinople in 1204 are absolutely horrifying. You know, if anyone's seen the last season of Game of Thrones, when you forget dragons circling above King's Landing, it's apocalyptic fire rained down upon the greatest Christian city by crusaders who claim to be fighting in the name of Christ. You know, they pillage great treasures of Constantinople. If you go to Venice, St. Mark's Basilica today, you can still see these fabulous bronze horse statues, which were taken in 1204 by the Venetians leading the crusade. There are some really mind-bending stories in this era.
And of course, crusades, you can't think of crusades and you can't think of crusaders without thinking of Templars. And you can't, you know, the gentlemen in the knights in white with the red cross, that is your basic idea of what a crusader should look like. And the crusades basically cemented the Templars as a military stroke religious force.
Well, yeah, the Templars come out of the sort of aftermath First Crusade and last up until they were destroyed in 1307 through 1314. They're kind of the first institutional body that represents crusading sort of permanently. So it's a fighting force of elite warriors, sort of SAS, you know, Green Berets, French Foreign Legion of the day, who are expert fighters but have also taken holy vows to live lives of poverty, chastity, and monastic style obedience. And their entire raison d'etre is to raise money to fight wherever they're needed in defense of the Christian church in the East or in Crusader war zones. And so they are, you know, their image over the years has come to really symbolize what a Crusader looked like. But of course, you know, they were one organization within a much bigger story.
Where did you go to, and what? Because it's such a vast, it's a vast sweep of history. Where did you get the information from to make this book different, rather than just giving it a chronological timeline of, you know, we sacked that city, Crusader states, Antioch, Battle of Acre? How do you bring the colour into this particular tale of Crusaders?
Well, there's two ways of doing it, and the first is the way the book's structured. Let's call it Crusaders rather than the Crusades, because it's divided into quite short chapters, each of which takes one person's viewpoint of a particular period. It's actually a technique borrowed from fiction. So if you read George R. R. Martin, you know, the Game of Thrones books, you'll see he uses a similar technique there. You see an episode from a single character's viewpoint, and that means I can rotate the characters and give you not just the sort of French knights, but also the Byzantine princesses and Arab poets and Turkic warlords and Mongol chieftains and lo and behold, some women in a story of the Middle Ages. So once you decide to do that, what I do is cast very carefully the characters who are going to take us through this story. So they're not just the usual crowd. And then you go find the sources, because a lot of them are all out there. They're just not used in the right way. So I'll give you an example. When I was writing about the Third Crusade, Richard the Lionheart and Saladin, I can't just tell the same old Third Crusade story again. So I found a Latin source, which is the account of the adventures of a woman called Margaret of Beverley. She's from Yorkshire in England, and she goes on pilgrimage to Jerusalem when she's a young woman, and she's there in Jerusalem when Saladin's army is besieging the city. And Margaret fights against Saladin's army with a saucepan on her head because she doesn't have a helmet, and she's throwing stones at the army down below her. When Jerusalem falls, she's captured. She manages to buy her freedom, but then she's captured again as she's leaving the city. She's enslaved. And all the time that Saladin and Richard are sort of duking it out up in Acre, Margaret is having a much different adventure of her own, which casts a whole new light on the experience of people in the Third Crusade. So, you know, the source is there. It's just barely used by historians. It's a case of going and finding it, seeing the way to knit it into the much bigger story. And that's what I think I've done in Crusaders. And I hope that when people read it, they'll go, wow, these are stories of the Crusades I've just never heard before.
And presumably, I mean, you put a face to the enemy, because Saladin, notwithstanding, who is seen as Richard's sort of greatest enemy, but also brothers in arms, if you like, in some sort of way, from a Western Christian point of view, there's not a lot of talk about who they were facing, apart from they seem to be despicable sort of savages or whatever you want to say them, who with, you know, gleaming scimitars, who are dispatched by the Knights Templar.
No, you're right, and the demonization of the other, of the enemy, in sort of traditionalist Western accounts of the Crusades, is not very helpful at all. Now, there is a sort of booming Islamic scholarship of crusading, and there are great writers about the Greek, the Greek experience of crusading. The historian's job, I think, today is to try and roll all of those experiences together, so that you see the human side from all angles. And that's one of the reasons I chose to call this book Crusaders, because by rotating through different viewpoints throughout the story and making sure that they sort of almost jar against one another, so you can flip-flap from a sort of a Frankish Western Christian perspective into the eyes of, let's say, a Sicilian Arab poet who's wandering the sort of kingdoms, the Islamic kingdoms of southern Spain, you can start to make these sources talk to each other, and you can start to see the kind of the shared humanity, without wanting to sound too sort of hippie-ish about it, but that's what's important, the shared humanity of people on all sides, all struggling with similar issues, but from different standpoints.
And one of the things that really made my eyebrows sort of raise is there was even a band of Vikings in there. How on earth did the Vikings get involved with the Crusades?
Is one of my favourite characters in the book. Well, look, there's been long connections between the Vikings, you know, Scandinavian warriors, and Eastern Mediterranean. So if you think about someone like Harald Hardrada, okay, Harald Hardrada was one of the people who invaded England in 1066. We don't think about him much because William the Conqueror won that war. But Harald Hardrada, great Viking leader, he'd been in Constantinople as a young man fighting in the Varangian Guard. He'd been a personal bodyguard of the Byzantine Emperor. There were lots of sort of communications between the Eastern Mediterranean and Scandinavia. But at the beginning, right after the First Crusade, beginning of the 12th century, a young Viking king of Norway called Sigurd I, just a teenager, decided he wanted a piece of the action. So he took 60 ships and 10,000 men on this epic, epic journey all the way from Norway via England, France, what's now Spain, Portugal, Balearic Islands, he stops on Menorca and Formentera, Sicily, eventually reaches Jerusalem, fights in a massive siege at the city of Sidon, now in Lebanon, goes off to Constantinople and rides home. Comes home with a fragment of the true cross and so much treasure that his ships have kind of a gleaming from their masks. They've attached treasure to the masts and sails. He's on a real old-school Viking mission of plunder on the one hand, yet it's also done under the banner of crusading. It's an amazing story. And again, just one of these sort of experiences of crusading that's very seldom written about, and people just don't know that these were some of the characters involved.
And of course, people say, oh, well, this is ancient history, this is hundreds of years ago, but there's still resonance, not only in, as you've said, in the way that we now think of relations between, and these religious wars are still going on, but if you scratch the surface and you look carefully, you will find you know, the remnants. I mean, Syria is full of Templar castles. There are stories. Robert Fisk, the journalist, wrote about people fighting in the castle of the Chevalier in Syria. And here in Spain, because I'm talking to you from Andalusia, Al-Andalus, of course, you know, there are 45 minutes from me is the castle of Tebba, where Black Douglas was famously dispatched by the Saracens in his own crusade, helping sort of during the reconquest. So, you know, it's only a short leap from what seems like the distant past to bring it right to life.
You're absolutely right, yeah. And in almost every country that was involved in crusading, you can still see monuments of or to the Crusades. You know, I live just outside London. You know, I go into London and walk down Fleet Street, you take a little turn off, you see the Temple Church, this beautiful round church consecrated in 1185. By the Patriarch of Jerusalem, who was visiting England at the time. And it's one of the most amazing buildings, ancient medieval buildings in London. It's been restored after it was bombed by the Nazis. You've got an absolute, you know, embarrassment of riches in Spain. You see the same in Portugal. You go to southern France. You see brilliant castles built by Hospitallers and Templars. And as you rightly say, out in Syria, I mean, I was in, not Syria, because it's still a bit too dangerous to visit, but... I went out to Jerusalem last October, and you can barely throw a stone in Jerusalem without hitting something that's Crusader era. It's a truly amazing place. There's a tattoo shop, in fact, just inside the Jaffa Gate, if you're in Jerusalem, called Razuk Tattoo, where you can still get a pilgrim tattoo on a design that dates back, you know, well, they claim they've been tattooing pilgrims since the year 1300. So all of this... it's still there. You know, you just have to, as you say, scratch the surface and you'll see it.
What do you hope that people will take from the book Crusaders?
I hope that they'll see that this was a much bigger story than we usually think, and that far from a tale of sort of two civilizations battling it out through the metaphor of, you know, Richard the Lionheart against Saladin, but actually this was an incredibly complex and rich history that lasted for almost the entire Middle Ages and had just some of the most fascinating characters you will ever read about involved in it.
The book is called Crusaders, an epic history of the wars for the Holy Land. It's out now by Head of Zeus. It's by Dan Jones. Dan, if people want to find out more about you or about the books, I know there's a website, social media.
Yes, I'm all over Twitter at DG Jones, Facebook / Dan Jones Historian, on Instagram, but there's loads of underscores and it'll take me 3 minutes to read out the name. I didn't think about it very carefully. You'll find me pretty easily online.
I only ask that begs the question, after the Crusaders and the Holy Lands, what's up next?
Well, I actually got another string to my bow. So I worked with a brilliant artist called Marina Amaral, and she colorizes black and white photographs from the past. So we did a book called The Color of Time last year, which is 200 of her amazing photos telling a story from 1860 through 1950. Sorry, 1850 through 1960. And we're doing another one of those for next spring, which is about the Long War, 1914 to 1945. In fact, I've just seen the cover and it has the most astonishing colorized Margaret Book White photograph from the Spanish Civil War on there. It's so that's going to be a lot of fun.
We look forward to that one. In the meantime, the current book is called Crusaders. It's by Dan Jones. Dan, thank you so much for your time today.
Absolute pleasure. Great talking to you.